This is Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee.
And here's the checkered flag. Pat Badan holds it and waves it for Mario Andretti, winner of the 1969 500-mile race.
A.J. Foyt down the main straightaway. The checkered flag is out. A.J.'s hand in the air. He is the winner. A.J. Foyt at Indianapolis has won his fourth 500-mile race.
Gordon Johncock off the fourth turn. Mears is right behind him. Johncock, Mears makes it dry. Johncock wins it by less than one-tenth of a second.
Danny Sullivan gets him. No, he's squirreling. No, he's spinning. Danny Sullivan spins, but he goes around twice and gathers it in.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
They're side by side. Emma on the inside.
Junior has the lead. One more turn to go.
The checkered flag is out. Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second.
We are inside 100 days to the 102nd Indianapolis 500 and 2.5 weeks from the 2018 Verizon IndyCar Series opener. Another off-season marker has passed. One of sport's longest seasons is underway with NASCAR's Daytona 500, which produced some talking points over the weekend. Ed Carpenter got a mention on the broadcast. He'll also join us to talk about the Phoenix test, the 2018 Aero kit, and adding Danica Patrick as a teammate for the 500. And plenty more on the program tonight. Thank you for joining us. I'm Kevin Lee. Kurt Cavan is here. Tony Donahue is our studio producer. We just had a show a few days ago.
That's right.
So that means if you've had trouble getting your Twitter question in, I suggest you try tonight. Tonight is your chance to go to the top of the line at Kevin Lee 23, at Kurt Cavan. Tag Kurt as well. We want Kurt to take over the Twitter questions tonight, so it's not just me talking so much. But we do have some things to talk about that I had on the table for last week. We're going to get into the Indianapolis 500. We started touching on that last week about where things look and much more on the program. And as mentioned, Ed Carpenter will join us to talk a myriad of subjects.
Myriad,
a,
I like
a
that.
A little bit. Daytona 500, good to see you as well. We're going to start with that because I think even though this is an IndyCar show, still the question is one that applies to all forms of motorsports. How do we all feel, keeping in mind with how the race was going and how much blocking was going on, how do we feel about the end of that race with Austin Dillon driving through Eric Almirola to win the race?
Well, you know, it's no secret here that I've never been a fan of basically doing something that in other sports would draw a whistle or a flag to win a race or to gain positions or what have you. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I just think, you know, they're gonna swallow the whistle in that situation where, and they probably would too, by the way, in the NCAA tournament. If I mean, you're gonna have to foul somebody pretty hard if it's a shot at the buzzer to draw the whistle, and same with pass interference. In fact, I saw the Super Bowl replay last night as I was flipping back and forth between the NBA All-Star game and the channel that had the 10 greatest games of last season. And so the Super Bowl was part of that, obviously. It was number one. But there was a comment made late in the game that you're not going to get a flag in that situation unless it's egregious.
So, have you ever seen pass interference called on a Hail Mary into the end zone? I don't believe I ever have.
Well, in fact, that's the call that didn't
that,
come
it,
because,
yeah.
Remember...
Just pin the guy's arms.
Number 15, Hogan. Wasn't Hogan
Chris
number...
Hogan? Uh-huh.
Chris Hogan. Chris Hogan got tackled on the Hail Mary.
Yep.
No call.
No.
So look, I don't expect NASCAR to throw the flag there either, but having said all that, I'm not a fan of using your car in that situation to create the passing opportunity. Having said all that, I do think that, and I don't know if I can best describe it. Perhaps you've got a better way of explaining it. The car, the way it sits low to the ground right now, is a difficult handful for drivers, and That wasn't the case maybe in that last sequence, but we saw a lot of those crashes were in fact, part of the issue was how the car is set up at the moment.
The trailing car.
Correct.
Right? And they described that on the broadcast, that you've lost all the downforce in the draft, so that means the car is very, very touchy and very easily, if you wiggle, to lose it and difficult to control. My first thought was, you know, it's a great storyline. Austin Dillon winning in the three 20 years after Dale Earnhardt won his only Daytona 500. Great story. Young driver winning. But the feeling is, I like good stories. Part of that's being a broadcaster. I'm looking for the best story. But that's not a pristine story, because you like to just celebrate the winner. And it's hard for me to celebrate the winner when you have to win in controversial fashion. Now, that's the way that race is run. And if you're up front, all you're doing is weaving back and forth the block. They'd been doing it all race. So at some point, you just decide, if you're second, that I've got the run, I'm coming. If you want to get up in my way, that's going to be your issue. And that's how it's deemed, and that's why I think a lot of, not all, but a decent amount of the NASCAR people say, no big deal there, including Almirola, who I think is somewhat just taking the high side, and good for him for not whining about it. But he publicly, his only comment was, no, I've got no problem with it. I would have done the same thing.
Interesting, though, that, and I wasn't in the media center yesterday, but the interesting takeaway that I came to the conclusion is that there were a lot of people who chose, maybe intentionally or not, rather than take that on from a columnist standpoint, the better story was the second place finisher, Bubba Wallace, that his emotional run to finish second in the Daytona 500 was a better story than maybe one that's, you know, difficult to, you know, you're not going to take sides. It's more difficult to take sides on whether or not that was an appropriate pass by the second place guy.
And the winner, it's not a rags to riches story. You know, Austin Dillon still has to get the job done. He's still a very competent, if not a very good race car driver. But the reality is, and some hold this against him, that, you know, as long as Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon can be competent, they were going to reach the cup level.
Sure.
That's just the way it was. And you've heard comments from other drivers about Silver Spoon, and Kevin Harvick, I think, is one. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was Newman. But, you know, they've taken criticism from other drivers before because their grandfather is the car owner, Richard Childress. So they have known all along once they started driving, or at least that's the perception. Now, the reality probably is, if they were that bad or unsponsorable, Richard probably wouldn't pay for this out of his pocket. He still has found sponsorship to back his two grandsons. But that's still, so it's harder to sell that story than if Eric Almirola wins the race, or, you know, name three or four other, you know, Matt DiBenedetto.
Nice.
Or Brendan Gaughan.
11 years, I've never heard you really stumble on a name.
Well, you've never heard me try to say Matt DiBenedetto, who I have met before, is a nice fellow. And I've always liked Brendan Gaughan. I like listening to Brendan Gaughan talk. I don't know him. I've chatted with him a few times, and he's great to talk with, but I can't say that I know him at all. But I was happy to see those two guys running in the top five, the top seven, late in the race. And that's the nature of that. When you knock out 10 other front runners, eventually you're going to get your Matt DiBenedetto at the end of the race. Your turn. Go ahead.
No. It's Matt. Brendan Gaughan, I spent time with last year at Pocono. So, Matt, yeah. Brendan Gaughan would have been a good post-race interview. He's very chatty. Very much wants to drive an IndyCar still. And I saw him get out of the car in that fire suit. He's probably not going to make it.
He's gotten a lot bigger, and he's basically retired. He's retired, and he's running the family casino. That's another guy that's doing pretty well.
By the way, that's a guy you forget was a college basketball player at Georgetown.
He was on the scout team and guarded Allen Iverson in practice every day.
How cool is that?
Can you see that going well?
No.
That doesn't seem like much competition for AI.
Especially when he gets out of the race car as he did yesterday.
But we're all older, and we're not as fit as we once were. But Those were good stories. I enjoyed the race. I thought the race was fairly entertaining.
I did too. I'm still not a fan of the segments. I understand the concept. I understand it adds more within the race. But maybe that's great at all the other races, but the Daytona 500, they kind of live on the edge the whole race. Why did we need to create a stopping point to reset the order?
Here's what I was surprised about. I'm okay with the stages, and I think it's added up some interest, and I think it really helps for the other races.
Yes.
I totally agree with you. It's not needed for Daytona, but it's still a series race, so you have to play it under the same rules. I'm surprised, though, that the drivers pay any attention at all, and they kept crashing at the end of the first stage and shortly before the end of the second stage. I would pay zero attention to stage points for the Daytona 500, just like, generally speaking, drivers don't pay attention to points for the Indianapolis 500. And if it made sense to, if you could work that in your strategy, and a few teams did do that, pit with three or four laps to go before the end of a stage and know you're going to cycle through, then I definitely would have done that, not only for that reason, but also because you are going to avoid the carnage.
Did you listen closely to the announcers? And it didn't matter whether it was Jeff Gordon or Darrell Waltrip, but they were kept using the example of those that are looking at the big picture. In other words, they were trying to say, pit, stop worrying about points. Stop worrying about a stage victory.
Yeah. And I'm surprised at how
they were
much,
trying to be very nice about it.
I'm surprised at how much the leader early in a race is worried about blocking to maintain the lead. Now, maybe the thought is, well, if I'm up front, then I won't be impacted when the big one happens. But still, unless you know you can get over, I just think there were too many close calls. When you're
sure.
Weaving to try to get in front of that line, let them go until you get to the third stage.
There's no question. And the blocking that was going on at those stage points really was pretty risky stuff, because you noticed virtually all the big crashes happened because one of the cars at the front had an issue. You know, either the
second. Yeah, this wasn't the backpack guys.
No.
These were the lesser names. These were the big heavy hitters making the mistakes or getting caught up in things. And it's so difficult to control.
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it a mistake, but yeah. I think they put themselves in positions where they didn't need to be. Now, one thing about Danica Patrick, I was watching that car, and we'll talk about her, I'm sure, just a little bit. But she seemed to be the only one that was giving some space in those stages. She was running 12th, 14th, and she was at least a car length back. She knew she was going to catch him. I mean, the train was going to push her there if she wanted to, if they wanted to do that. But she actually created a little separation. Now, it didn't help her when the crash in front of her actually happened. But I just don't understand, especially when it's lap 60, the Daytona 500, you're not going to lose a lap. What are you doing? I mean, unless you're just trying to get TV time.
Just need to stay in that lead draft. It doesn't matter even if you're at the end of it. You can still very quickly get back up front. Now, Chris Robertson, NDWR3A, says not as much blocking for leader, but trying to get the aero bump needed to stay up front, part of plate racing. So that's part of it, too. If you need to, if you get too big of a lead, you've got to move up in a lane where somebody's coming, or you will go to the back of the line. So it is part of it. I wish if you're a NASCAR fan, I think it wouldn't be ideal that your biggest race is so much decided by luck. It's so random. Now, it doesn't mean you don't need skill and talent and a good car and no mistakes on pit road or very few mistakes to win. But yes, I understand you have to have luck in the Indianapolis 500, but in only one other race or one other track, Talladega, is it dependent on the guy behind you?
Right.
And that's not ideal. I still can enjoy this three times a year. I guess it's four times a year. I wouldn't want to see any more than that of this type of racing, because it works out well because it's been so long since we've seen racing that I think I put up with it. But I wouldn't want to see where there's that little in the hands of the driver very often.
Yeah. It was still an interesting watch.
I thought so.
And you felt, you know, one of the things there, and maybe this is good or bad, but you feel the tension for a long period of time. And that's one of the reasons why the stage doesn't particularly appeal to me, is because they'd stop that tension for a period of time and let everybody come in and pit, regather, probably, you know, get their nerve back up. But I wish they'd just kind of let it go. Let's just see, you know, let's see who's ready to make a move, who's not, without fear of, you know, they're going to stop it here. Not fear, but, you know, without a planned stoppage.
I'm okay with the stages, and one, because you need to have stoppages. You need TV timeouts, and this is a guaranteed.
You
TV.
Like TV timeouts.
I do like TV timeouts, because if not, you're going to get fake cautions. You're going to get more fake cautions. And as people were complaining about the number of commercials at the end of the race, hey, that's business.
Yeah, that's business.
That's what happens when you're charging $1 billion or whatever it is for your television contract. They need to sell a lot of commercials. And they're probably not selling those commercials for as much money as they were 5 years ago. So that means they need to play even more commercials. That's just the way it's going to be if the sport wants to take in the amount of money that they've been taking in at this point. Some good storylines for NASCAR in that they're young drivers. They're trying to get this next generation taking over for Gordon and Stewart and Junior and Kenseth and others. So, you know, you've got Blaney running up front, who I think is a good personality and is someone that people can like. I think Chase Elliott is in that same category and already has the big-time built-in name recognition and a fan base behind him. Bubba Wallace, you know, Richard Petty mentioned this, that I think this guy's got a chance to be a superstar. He's maybe a little biased because he's on his team, but as you said, that's the story that's getting the most traction after the race,
sure,
in part because of his emotions in the post-race, but from a storyline standpoint, I thought it went pretty well for them.
Yeah, I think so too. Given that they, now we've seen this in IndyCar racing too. When you lose in a race, if you take out the names, when you take out Kyle Busch, Kurt Busch, Keselowski, Jimmy Johnson, you know, you started losing those to crashes, Danica Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
You lost a lot of those drivers early in the race. And that does have an impact on how long you sustain your fan base, especially when a race, you know, is as lengthy as that one is. You know, we sit here and say that it makes a good storyline that when they get to the last 10 drivers, you know, the TV broadcasters will say something along the lines of, look at all these great storylines in the first 10. Well, the reality is the fan base doesn't show up for the great storylines.
And the casual fan that maybe watches one race a year flips through and sees Matt DiBenedetto and Brendan Gaughan up in the top five. That doesn't necessarily keep them there.
Exactly. Yeah, so, yeah, you know, you lose your star power early, and I think they made the best of it. And I think, you know, you had some interesting things. The last caution really hurt them, in my opinion, or the last major accident, because they had a sequence where you had, you know, 14, 16 cars. And then they go to the radio and I forget which driver it was that said it, but said, how many cars are really left in this without damage? And they said, I think they said 8. You know, that's not the kind of...
And there was about 4 or 5 we thought could win.
Right. Yeah. So I think had that last crash not happened, they would have been really positioned well. And they had a lot more of their name value drivers still in the hunt.
John Day at 81 Indy, if winning a NASCAR race requires constant blocking and or running over the cars in front of you, then the win isn't going to the fastest or the best, but rather to the biggest bully on the track.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know about that. It is about, you know, understanding the draft, understanding where to have your car at the right time. How many times have we talked about this? Do you make the move now, or do you make it too soon or too late? I mean, there's a lot of strategy that goes into it, and you're going to have some unsettling of the car in front of you. If you're running close, that's going to happen. But, you know, it's when you lay the bumper and you create the space that you need that's a little tough for some people to take.
Daniel Bragg, 2018, says all tracks should only be visited once, with the exception to chase tracks in Daytona. Well, I think there's something to that, and I think that's why there could be some validity to the Sports Business Journal story I brought up last week, that there is a feeling that they need to do some drastic changes to the schedule, and there would be some tracks that would lose a second race, but nobody within the company wants to give up that money. So how do you do that? The only way might be to consolidate everything, and it's all in one big pot anyway, and then you could choose the tracks and the markets and the venues that make the most sense for your schedule. It's probably, I don't know if it will happen in this TV contract, but that might be something that comes into play for the next TV contract, which I think we're just about already halfway through. About 5 years or so left in this 10-year television contract. Maybe it's five after this year.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. You've, you know, if you're going to reduce, it depends on, you know, how many races you think you're going to have in the season. At the moment, you want to have this many for the TV contract. But if you got to the end of the contract and they said, and NASCAR said, we're only going to have 25 races and go to the tracks one time each, except for the Chase in Daytona, then you're not going to get as much money for 25 races as you got for 36, plus an all-star race, plus Daytona qualifying, for example. But, you know,
probably not, but maybe television says we won't drop it that much because we'll save so much money.
Maybe.
That we think that we'll, yes, lose some inventory, but it will be a little bit more valuable. And keep in mind, motorsports is the most expensive thing in sports to broadcast. That's why a .3 rating for a college basketball game is not equal to a .3 rating for a motorsports event, because the motorsport event, I wish I knew what the actual number was, whether it's, is it 10 times more expensive? Is it 25 times more expensive? Is it only 4 times more expensive? But it's a lot more expensive to do a race than it is to do a basketball game.
Yeah, fair enough. It's because you announcers, it costs, you just have
much
more.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's it.
Higher standards.
Or the 35 cameras compared to whatever it is, 5 or 6 in a basketball game. We'll get to more of your Twitter questions, and we'll get into IndyCar now, coming up at KevinLee23, at Kurt Cavan, and we'll chat with Ed Carpenter in just a moment. It's Trackside, 107.5, 1070, The Fan.
Come on, buddy.
Race into turn number 3. Will Ed Carpenter be able to get his first win in the Eyes on IndyCar Series? Here they come to the line. And it is
Carpenter.
Ed Carpenter wins. How about that?
That was good stuff.
He finally does it. Second place the last 2 years. And Ed Carpenter gets the victory. Oh, man, what a finish.
Trackside with Cavan and Kevin on 1070 The Fan.
How about that? Our next guest, Ed Carpenter, joining us. That's the great Bob Jenkins on Versus at the time with the call of Ed Carpenter's first IndyCar win. I still remember that. I think the night before we had run into you in 2011 at dinner, and I think Bob called the shot. He told you, I think you're going to win tomorrow. Do you recall that? Yeah.
Back, so that was a good day.
That was a good day. That was a fun day. We miss that track, and we miss seeing you in victory lane. We've got a lot of things to talk about tonight, and we'll talk about Danica and you getting some on-air mentions on the NASCAR broadcast yesterday. That was cool. But I want to talk about the Phoenix test and your chance to get back in the car for the first time in a little while. What did you think of the 2018 Aero kit? How did it go for you and the team?
It was good. I mean, overall, it was good. I would have liked to have been a little faster on the speed charts at the end of the day. But, you know, we had been on track there once before. I had been in the car at Texas, but it was our first real chance to be there with a bunch of cars. And, you know, I think we're all still learning. I think you saw, you know, regardless of the team, you know, you had teammates who were good, teammates who were still figuring things out, working through their program. So, you know, it's a lot different than the old car, and it requires some different things from the car and setup perspective, and certainly requires the drivers to drive it a little differently too. So it's going to be an exciting year for everyone learning that, getting used to it, and, you know, going to be a big reward to those who figure it out quickly.
We'll stay off the setup standpoint for a moment. From a driver perspective, what are you feeling that's different? What do you need to do differently on the short oval?
I mean, it's specifically at Phoenix, you know, it's so much less downforce, and we also have a different tire there this year. So there's two factors that are different. But, you know, in the past at Phoenix, we really haven't had that much tire degradation. And now combination of the tire and this new aero configuration with way less downforce, you have a lot less grip from the aerodynamics. So we're working the tires harder. We're relying on the mechanical setup a lot more, and the tires don't last long. You've got a couple good laps in them, and then the lap time goes away. So, yeah, I think that's why you saw kind of some of the lap charts spread around there, because if you didn't get a lap in on your first couple laps, it was hard to post a better time after that. So, you know, a lot more work in the pedals. You know, I don't know that anyone was flat. Maybe a couple guys close in 3 and 4. Maybe in qualifying it'll happen, but there won't be any laps flat in the race, that's for sure.
Yeah, that sounds like a recipe for mixing it up on, as we saw, I think, at least I thought we saw in the fourth practice session or the last one of the day on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it'll be like just like that. I think that was exaggerated a little bit because people were trying to shuffle around and get themselves deeper into a group of cars. But, you know, the other thing, we saw some long runs there, but, you know, a full stint at Phoenix is 60-plus laps, and we didn't see anybody go that deep. And I really, the second half of a stint on tires, I think you're really going to see a lot more drop off from people, you know, and that'll certainly open up more passing opportunities than what we had there last year, where really, you know, you're maybe only dropping a couple of tenths of a second over new tires to the tires at the end of a run. And, you know, I think you're going to be seeing, you know, a second and a half to 2 second type of drop off now. So guys that have a better handling car, take care of the tires a little better, you know, relative to others, you're going to see a lot more different paces out there late in stints.
And that kind of leads to what I wanted to talk about next. And keep in mind that, you know, Phoenix is not going to be like Texas or Chicagoland or Kentucky. It's always going to be more challenging to pass. But to try to produce the most passing that's possible in the best racing, is it about finding the right mix of tire degradation? Is it about adding back a little bit more downforce? Is it taking off a little more downforce? How do you find the right formula?
I think for there, the tire degradation is going to help a lot. You know, and then combine that with the fact that the cars are just harder to drive with less downforce. You know, you're going to have more mistakes being made, which we already saw at the test. You know, there were quite a few guys that made mistakes. You know, so yeah, it's going to be different. And that's Phoenix. You know, we still got a lot to learn about other places. You know, I think the other factor is the cars, they accelerate so much quicker, you know, with having that much less downforce. It's also a lot less drag. So they accelerate quicker, regain their speed quicker. So, you know, that's going to be something that'll help there more so than other places, just because the straightaways are so short, it was hard to get runs before. So the fact that they accelerate quicker now should make it easier to get a run, capitalize on someone else's mistake.
Ed Carpenter is joining us. You mentioned you've been in the 2018 Aero Kit car at Texas. Early days for that, but what did you think?
It was good. You know, a place like that, it's not as different as Phoenix. You know, in the short oval, high downforce road course configuration with this new car, you know, it's a much bigger loss of downforce than what we'll see at a place like Texas or Indianapolis. There, it's not as much of a reduction. It's still less, but it's not, you know, it's not in the thousands of pounds type of reduction. So I think that it'll be more similar there, but again, the cars still accelerate quicker. So, you know, I think they, you know, when I was at Texas, it was Will Power and myself, or no, Joseph. Joseph was doing that test for Penske when I was there. And certainly it closed up quicker in the draft there as well. So it's hard to really know when there's just two cars there and we're testing tires and doing different things to really get a feel for what it's going to be like. But it'll be different, but I think it will be less different than a place like Phoenix.
Let me ask you about one of your employees. I'm sure we'll talk about the future employees, but the one that probably isn't getting a lot of talk just yet, but I think is ready for really a breakout season, is Spencer Pigot. What have you seen the last couple of years as he's grown into this role of being a lead driver?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at Spencer's whole career up to this point and the arc of his career, you know, he's a winner. He's been a champion everywhere he's driven. And, you know, I feel like he's that caliber of driver in IndyCar too. He just needs to continue his development. And that was, you know, probably the biggest factor in deciding to move him into a full-time role was that's what he needed for the next step of his development. You know, he raced really well last year and even the year before, but last year specifically, you know, we didn't always qualify the best, and we didn't get as many results as what we could have, but in quite a few races, he was doing a great job, passed a lot of cars. He has a good ability to work the car in the brake zones. I think he's an excellent passer, and he just needs more time. He needs to be in the car more, and I think him racing the full schedule and becoming more well-rounded is just going to make him better where he's already strong. And, you know, I think we'll see hopefully some more pace out of him this year when it comes to qualifying stuff as well. And he's a pro. He deserves to be full-time. You know, I think even Phoenix, you know, it was a big step for him, probably more so this year than even than years before, just because of all the change. But he did a really nice job at the Phoenix test and was getting more comfortable all the time. You know, I'm really excited about being teammates with him and just seeing his overall development continue.
Ed Carpenter drives the number 20 Fuzzy's Vodka Chevrolet for Ed Carpenter Racing, and you'll share that car this year with young Jordan King. Tell me about him, what you saw in him, and what you think he can do on the road and street courses in the number 20.
I think Jordan can be another surprise this year. You know, I don't think a lot of people are necessarily familiar with him. It's hard to keep an eye with all the series around the world, but we're still getting to know him. I'd met him the first time in 2016, so her relationship goes back a little ways, but you know, he's been in the car for a day at Sonoma. We actually stayed and he tested at Phoenix after the open test was over. And, you know, he's a very talented driver. He showed some speed at Sonoma. He's adapting to the car really quickly. He's very technical, has good feedback. So still a lot to learn, you know, to actually see him race over here. But, you know, so far so good. I'm excited for him. You know, he's definitely putting in all the work and taking this opportunity very seriously. And, you know, I won't be surprised if he turns some heads when we get to St. Pete either.
I told Kurt this on the air a couple of weeks ago, that some people that would know have told me, don't discount this guy. He's pretty good. He might be someone that surprises people this year. So that'll be interesting to watch. And by the way, I think I told you this when I saw you in Phoenix. Thank you for differentiating the two cars. We love that.
Well, you're welcome. I don't want to totally spoil the news, but I don't know that how different they'll be in St. Pete. But
I'm not doing that race, so I don't care.
But most races will be different, but at St. Pete, they might not be all that different.
Well, that's Alan Bestwick's problem, so we're not worried about that.
Well, I know you're on different networks, but I like Alan. I like Alan as well. You guys both do a good job.
We do too. We think Alan's great, but that's his. And Alan must be better because it won't bother him at all. He'll get it figured out. And the guys on ABC.
I'll talk to Eddie and Scott and make sure I point out the differences when we get down there, so they can tell us apart when we're running up front together.
Let's move to Indianapolis. I know there was a big plan of a big announcement at some point, and then Well, that doesn't always go according to plan, but it worked out because I think a pretty large media contingent became aware of your team, and maybe you get a little love for your partners as well. Danica Patrick coming in a third car for Indianapolis. How did this all come together? Were you hearing your name for a while? What ultimately got the deal done for your team?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a process. There was some early talks, you know, going back into early off season, and, you know, we really just weren't in a position to really get involved or get serious with it because I didn't want to do anything until we had our full lineup sorted out.
Okay.
I knew that we wouldn't want to run more than one extra car at Indy, and until we knew who and how the 20 car road course program was going to work out, and if that would include an Indy only element to it, it kind of made us a little bit of a late factor with our involvement in talking to Danica and her group. But, you know, I like to think that everything worked out. I was really, really happy to have Jordan on the team, like we were talking about earlier. And, you know, the fact that she hadn't made a decision or hadn't gotten a deal done elsewhere allowed us to get back in the running to be a part of her final IndyCar race and final race altogether. So really excited about it. You know, I'd spoken to her management, and then once it got serious, Danica and I started having talks, and really from that point, made a lot of progress, and we both want the same things, and I'm excited for it. I'm excited to get her to the shop, and, you know, now that Daytona's over, get her in our program and working with the team and getting prepared for a great month of May.
So the point was raised, I don't know, a couple weeks ago about, you know, the additional oval track experience she's had over the years will be beneficial. But she's been out of an IndyCar for quite some time. How do you balance those two perspectives? And I guess maybe it doesn't really matter. You get her in the car at the start of May and see where it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a period of her getting reacclimated to these cars. But, you know, at the same time, if we do our job as a team and have good cars, that's going to make that transition a whole lot easier. You know, and she has the experience. She put in a lot of time and a lot of miles at Indianapolis, and it is a different car. But, you know, I really, in a lot of ways, I actually think that it will probably be more similar to how it was when she left IndyCar than how the cars have felt the past several years. So I don't really worry about that part as much. And, you know, like you were alluding to, Kurt, you know, she's been racing NASCAR since 2012, and, you know, she's logged a lot of miles there. As we know, they have a lot of races and a lot of long races, you know, way more 500 mile plus races than what we have in a season. And, you know, I think no matter what kind of car you're driving, you're always improving as a driver and becoming more experienced and learning more things. And I'm sure that she'll, in some ways, be better here than she was when she left, especially once she gets reacclimated to this car and the speed of an Indy car versus a stock car. But, you know, I think when you look at how quickly Kurt Busch made the transition when he was here a couple years ago, you know, she'll be in a better position than he was just with her Indy car experience. But you saw how he was able to transition his skills and experience from NASCAR and really be a factor immediately when he got here in the IndyCar. So I don't worry about the fact that she's been away. She knows what she's doing, and she's always been excellent at Indianapolis, and I don't see it being any different this year.
Will Danica get to test on March 27th, or have you asked for any other special consideration, like Fernando Alonso had last year with an extra private test day?
We're working on that. I'm not sure what day it'll happen around that time, but I expect her to be in the car at some point, kind of in that week of testing. There's the open test, and then there's a couple other tests that week on the oval. So we're working out the details of that, but I'm sure we'll have her in the car before then. We just have to kind of work around the logistics and testing rules and figure out what the best option is for her and the team as well.
A couple of Twitter questions for you from Snarky Moose. He says, be sure to ask Ed why he thinks the other teams are wrong to consider Danica a distraction. That was a public comment from a couple of teams that we thought might be destinations, and the comment from the team owners was we didn't really want the extra distraction that adding her would provide. Why is this not a distraction for your team?
I don't know. It's hard to comment on what other people say or feel. You know, people, the questions obviously come up, and Indy's always a busy time and stressful time, but you know, the way I look at it is it's a great opportunity. You know, it's only, distractions are only a distraction if you allow them to become a distraction. If you have a good plan and stick to your plan, and more than anything, if you're having a good month, which we fully expect to be having, you know, it makes things a lot easier too. But I see it as an opportunity way more so than a distraction. So I think it's going to be a fun month.
I read you commented on a similar question, and I wish I knew which outlet it was in. I guess it would have been just last week. And you said, well, Fernando Alonso wasn't on my team last year, but yet I was asked about Fernando Alonso every single day, so I might as well have her on my team. Because, right, every driver is going to be asked about Danica, whether they're on her team or not.
Exactly. I mean, I talked to Fernando a couple times last May, but I sure talked about him a lot, as everyone did. So, you know, clearly, you know, Danica's return to Indianapolis and her final race, all of that, it's going to dominate the discussion over the course of the month of May. You know, people are going to want to know how she's doing every single day. And, you know, that to me is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to be a part of her, the end of her racing career and that history. And it's also an opportunity for us to showcase Ed Carpenter Racing and, and what we're capable of.
Michael Goodyear, 007, says, I'd like to hear Ed's memories of winning at Indy for A.J. Foyt back during the 03 Indy Lights season. Knowing A.J.'s feelings about the Speedway and winning there, how cool was it to share that with a true legend of the sport? That was the weekend you graduated from college, too, right?
Yeah, it was. And also went on my first date with Heather, my wife. So that was an unbelievable week, probably easily the most important week of my life.
Did she agree after you won or before you won?
It was before.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Yeah. So we had our first date a couple of days before that race win. So it was great. That whole season working with AJ and Jack Starn, who is kind of my crew chief and kind of ran the lights program. It was a lot of fun, but you know, I have a lot of memories from that race with AJ and, you know, some of the decisions that we made going into the race, probably different than other people. At the time, there were two different ring and pinions you could run in the gearbox. They had made a faster one because that was by far faster than any other lights track at the time. And we just ran the one we had been running because AJ said it was going to be better. And I was like, okay, you know what you're doing around here. I don't know what I'm doing yet. I'm just going to listen to you. And that was really, I think, the difference. We were really good on restarts. Mark Taylor passed me once on a start, but I was able to pass him right back. And I attribute that to AJ's decision. And they had the lights cars figured out at that point. You know, I ran for him in 03 and in 02. Anthony dominated that year, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, I'll forever appreciate that year with AJ. He was always one of my heroes growing up, and to be able to say that I drove for him is still something special to this day. And to be honest, if it wouldn't have been for that win, I don't know that I would have the opportunity to run the three IndyCar races I did later that year with PDM, which ultimately opened the door for me to get a chance with Eddie Cheever's team. So everything happens for a reason, and that was a good week in May.
I even forgot that you drove for PDM. That's a good one. That's a good memory.
Yeah. I've been around so long, Kurt. You know,
well, we both have. Things. Yep.
And Heather's
the nicest girl in the paddock. I don't know how you're like two misfits in that respect. I mean, you're not that nice.
Yeah. I'm not that likable of a guy. And for sure, the majority of my friends or our friends, I don't know that they would be around if it wasn't for Heather. So it makes me a better person for sure.
When's your team test next?
We are going down to Sebring next. I think the 27th is the day we're on track. I have a hard time keeping track.
I think that's right. I know there's a test the 27th, 28th. Yep. Okay.
27th, we're on track down there.
Okay. Hey, it's good to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It was good to hear your name on national television yesterday during February. That was good.
Yeah, I haven't heard back from DW. I responded on Twitter, but he probably has a million replies he's got to look at when a 500 marathon of a race is over. But yeah, I appreciated that shout out. It's cool that he's watching a little bit of our racing and knows the players. And yeah, I threw out an invite. So I doubt he's listening to this show, but if he is, you know, we'd love to
probably
host
not.
Him out of the track for a practice day. You never know. You just don't know.
You're usually listening, so there's a chance he might.
Exactly.
So he knows your name. I when I do the ARCA races for Fox, usually I go into the booth after like a NASCAR practice or qualifying. So I'm following up DW and Jeff and Mike Joy, and I know Jeff and Mike Joy a little bit. And it was still like the second or third race of the year, and they're in a commercial break, and I'm standing in the back, and he waves hello. Hey, Phil Parsons is the analyst, and then he points to me and says, "Who are you?" I met you 2 weeks ago, but that's all right. Good to see you, DW. So that's my story.
Well, hopefully he remembers you next time.
I don't think so. I don't think so, and it's really not that critical. It's not that critical because he's not in charge of whether I stay employed. So I'm okay with that.
Time,
I like
next
DW.
If it happens, just be like, DW, we've met before. My name's Kevin. I expect you to remember next time.
I'll do that.
And I bet he will.
Okay. It's good to talk with you. We will see you in warmer climate very soon.
Yep, it can't come soon enough.
Exactly. Ed Carpenter, the number 20 Fuzzies Ultra Premium Vodka Chevrolet for Ed Carpenter Racing. Thanks, Ed. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
See you, bub.
Stay with us. More to come. We get to your Twitter questions, comments, and other stuff at Kevin Lee 23 at Kurt Cavan. It's Trackside on 107.5, 1070 The Fan.
This is Eddie Castroneves. You are listening to Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee on 1070 The Fan.
Speaking of Elio, I saw on Twitter, I was out of town this weekend, but I saw that he was one of those at the celebration at IMS for the 100 Days Out party. I don't know what you'd officially call it, but it was
a
shindig on Saturday night.
Friday night.
Yeah, because I did get back Saturday night. So a pretty good contingent of star power there. You had two 500 winners. You had Alexander Rossi, television superstar, and Elio Castroneves, television superstar, and both have won the Indianapolis 500. Who else was there?
Kyle Kaiser, I know, was one of those that was there.
Yep. I think there was one or two other drivers there, too. So that was good, and it looked like there was a good turnout. I know you had to sign up for tickets ahead of time, so I mentioned at the end of the show last week, I didn't worry about it too much because I knew that you couldn't get in. You either had a ticket by last week when the invites went out early on, and it looked like there was a good crowd there.
And I would tell you that one of the ways that people got invited is through IndyCar Nation, which is the fan club of the series. And so there are different ways you can join, different levels, different opportunities that come as a result of that. If you haven't looked into it, I would offer that it be a good way to kind of get to some of those kind of things.
And Elio apparently gave us a little bit of news that he will be in the car before he gets to Indianapolis. He will test on the road course at Barber, and one of the tests coming up next month with is the similar program that Juan Pablo Montoya did.
Yep.
He did the same thing last year, and I think he said he would also be a part of the test on the oval on March 27th at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So that's good. We'll get to see Elio for two races in an Indy car, and he's going to be the Grand Marshal. I think that's the title.
Grand Marshal
for the St. Pete race coming up, so it will be good to celebrate him there.
So the promoter will use him in a variety of different ways during race week, and so he'll probably be as visible as any Grand Marshal has been lately.
It's going to work out well. You'd like to do that with everyone, but they're busy that weekend.
Right.
Elio will have some time to make
the rounds.
He will be made use of that time as he prepares for his two IndyCar races along his sports car schedule. All right, we immediately get to tweets when we come back, and much more on the way on Trackside. Number two, Trackside, from the drivehubler.com studios in downtown Indianapolis. Tony Donahue is our in-studio producer while David Deering is relaxing.
I think he's recovering from Kyle Busch's issues in the Daytona 500.
But at least he didn't go. He watched on television, so he didn't have that to deal with.
I'm sure it doesn't alter his disappointment.
He spent the day arguing with people on Twitter, as I noticed. That was good. Tony noticed that as well. With Kurt Cavan, I'm Kevin Lee. We seek your input. I have things on the docket that I want to talk about, but I'm always curious what you're interested in, and we have a little more time to be able to do so in this hour at Kevin Lee 23. We had an in-studio guest, but you know, as I've said before, alas, people think, what do these guys do when they're not driving? You only have 16, 17 weekends a year. Trust me, they are somewhere all the time, because you have so many partners you have to work with, and you've got basically a new car you're trying to figure out. You have engineering sessions and simulations and so forth.
And you'd like to stay married.
Yes, that would help too in some cases. Not all cases is that applicable, but some they are. By the way, next week's show, we're back to Tuesday. So Tuesday the 27th, I'm Ron Burgundy. Yes, Tuesday the 27th, yes. From 7 until 9 is our program next week. And then we're going to be really getting into racing. We're going to be up before the week of the St. Pete race. That was the only sad part I had after leaving Phoenix. Two sad parts: not getting to stay for the test, and the second was, you know, wow, race season is here. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, I don't get to come back to an IndyCar race for 2 months.
You can always come back.
Well, I can't the St. Pete weekend unless you fly me down there and put me up and put me to work. But I do have another assignment on that Saturday that would keep me from thinking about making that a vacation weekend. So we have the second race on NBC, but yet that's still 2 months after the test. So I bounced out of that quickly because you've still got a lot of activity, and I'm going to get to sit on my couch, and I'm going to watch, I think, depending on what the weather is like. If it's really nice, I might do my old DVR track, but I'm thinking of consuming it like normal people do and watching it live and sitting through commercials, and that way I can use the Verizon app for timing and scoring and participate on Twitter. I never tweet out thoughts on sporting events because, well, they've been over for an hour and a half.
Yeah, I watched the Daytona 500 yesterday live, and it was
live.
Live.
See, maybe that's why I enjoyed it so much, because I sat down at 3:15 and watched the pre-race show.
So yeah, I didn't do that.
So I never caught up. So I'm just fast forwarding all the way through. And, you know, three commercials in the last 15 laps doesn't bother me because I'm just moving through things.
Well, as you know, you've trained me really well to get on the DVR schedule, and I almost never watch, to the point now when, as you know, I watch a lot of Butler basketball games. My friends don't even text me now about the outcome, good or bad, because they know that sometimes when we were in Phoenix, I was 2 days behind the Butler game.
You stayed away from the result for two days?
I did.
That's difficult. That's impossible.
No, I just decided not to read Indy Star for a couple days and didn't look for any David Woods tweets on my Twitter account. If I happen to see one, I kind of scroll through real fast, try not to read.
It's tough. Okay.
But So yeah, for me to actually watch a race live, I felt like a common person.
I watched the truck race on the FS Go app on Friday night live.
That's dedication.
FS1 was not in the hotel that I was in Lexington. Marty Snyder's son, Myatt, is running full-time in the truck series.
Okay,
fair enough. And from ARCA, I've gotten to know, I bet I know five or six kids. Dalton Sargent, whose brother Logan runs F4 cars in Europe, and he was an open-wheel guy, nice kid. He's running full-time in the trucks this year, and I've met three or four other guys. But mostly I was watching to root on Myatt, who led briefly, ran up front, was good, and got collected in somebody else's crash. So that was interesting. The Xfinity race was a bit like the ARCA race in that it wouldn't end, but wow.
Yeah, great finish.
Basically a tie. It was, for those that didn't see it, it was .000, and their timing and scoring boards don't go to the fourth one. So I was listening, driving back from the Kentucky-Alabama basketball game, and the MRN guys didn't know who won. They had to wait 10 or 15 seconds until NASCAR told them on the scanner that who won the race? I don't even remember. Tyler Reddick. Tyler Reddick is who won the race. So that was, and then I watched that race when I got home, skipping through, you know, a lot of the red flags and so forth. So I still consumed a lot of motorsports this weekend. That's another positive that I find to the condensed IndyCar schedule, that I consume the other forms of motorsports, watching the Rolex closely, watching the first two or three NASCAR races until IndyCar starts, and then I really don't have time to see a lot of NASCAR or pay much attention until the IndyCar season is over, and then I pick it up again for their final few races for the championship, and the same with Formula One, the beginning of the season and the end of the season. I got off on a tangent. A couple of things I wanted to mention.
Yeah, we did go off on a tangent.
That tends to happen when there's not a ton of news, but there are things I want to mention. I saw this headline that Cosworth is seeking an engine partner for IndyCar for motorsport.com. I would also say I don't think that's new news. I think they've been seeking a partner for quite some time, but always good to see the story out there. And the news part of it out of there was that they have had about 10 meetings, and you know they've had some follow-ups, and there is some interest. It's no different than the storyline we've been seeking. They need an OEM.
They need someone to badge it. They need an original manufacturer to badge the engine. They've had relationships in the past with Ford and with Chevrolet. Cosworth has in the IndyCar series, and in CART. But you know, that's the stipulation, kind of the marketing arm behind Cosworth, or behind Cosworth's engines. Cosworth is certainly capable of building IndyCar engines. They've done so on many occasions in the past. I'm sure they'll do it in the future. They're looking for somebody at this point to do it. And I guess that's
one of the rules for IndyCar.
That is an IndyCar rule.
It needs to be someone that has some marketing power behind them.
Exactly. I'm glad you clarified that. It isn't just because we want to link up with a manufacturer brand name. That is certainly important. But you need somebody to promote who can sell things to consumers. And at this point, Cosworth and Ilmor and the various engine manufacturers that exist in the world of motorsport, they don't have a branding need, if you will, or a marketing need.
Over the years, you know, we always hear OEM, so I've tried to make it a point where I can remember what OEM stands for, Original Equipment Manufacturer. And then you think about it, and that term is really a misnomer,
yeah,
because they're not the manufacturer of the equipment.
Right.
They're actually the brand. They're the name, and someone else is doing the work. And this doesn't just apply to engines and motorsports. That's a phrase that's used outside of motorsports.
So OEM would be Toyota, Audi, Chevrolet, and Honda, and Ford, and kind of go down the list of the people that actually sell cars.
I want you to work on that, though. It should be better branded than OEM.
It really
OEM.
Should.
OEM.
But the OEMs
use it. I feel like Cosworth is more the original manufacturer.
It really is.
And they just need a brand for that.
But the OEMs are calling themselves OEMs, so that's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. I saw this.
They've branded themselves an OEM.
Last week I saw this story in Auto Week. And again, I don't think this is new news, but you know, it kind of makes the rounds in the IndyCar world, so we'll comment on it. Fontana and Las Vegas tracks still open to IndyCar comeback.
Well, I think, one, I'm trying to look at this objectively. if I was running one of those tracks, I would say the same thing.
Because
you never know when the deal is right or when the opportunities are right or when the sport is so popular that you'd want them back at, I wouldn't say any cost. That's not the right phraseology, but you'd certainly want them to be a customer at your facility.
And then you read the story, and the story is well done and does explain things. And even in the story, when you get to the quotes from the Las Vegas president,
Chris Powell,
he basically says it ain't happening. You know, when once we've added the second cup race, that makes it much more difficult to find space on the schedule. But then, you know, he finishes it as he should with never say never if the right deal came around. I'll say it. It's highly, highly unlikely that IndyCar is going to race at Las Vegas Motor Speedway in the next few years for business reasons, and I still think for emotional reasons, too. And that's – it doesn't need to come into the emotion because the business isn't going to make sense for a little while. I just don't see it happening
I probably agree with that.
I do think that, you know, you can figure out a way, and if I got the drivers on board – after talking with the people making up the rules, then I could feel comfortable with it. The drivers would need to say, okay, this makes sense. This is what we're going to do. And it can be done, but I think it'll be a lot easier to do in 10 or 15 years when there's no one driving that knew driving in that race.
And it's not just that. That banking is different than some other places. I mean,
yeah.
it has a banking system that isn't as conducive to an IndyCar as some other places. So it's not just about emotion. It's not just about the business sense.
And having 34 cars makes it different than what you're normally going to have, too. If you have your normal 22, 23 cars, I think that lessens your chances of – I think it lessens the danger. That was likely a factor involved in that.
Perhaps. But you know, there are multiple factors.
Yep.
In Las Vegas.
Yep. Now, Fontana is a different story. Now, I don't think it's likely that's going to happen anytime soon, but I do believe Dave Allen, right?
Yes.
That, you know, he'd be interested. Again, it takes the right circumstances, and I'm not going to say that I feel this is pending, but I do think there's a sliver of a chance. I'm going to put the chances still pretty slim in the next few years, mainly because of schedule. As long as IndyCar still wants to stop around mid-September, it's going to be difficult because it's so hot there in the summertime and because of their NASCAR races. It probably would take that revamping of the Cup schedule. And if something like that does happen, then
yeah, I think
maybe that opens the possibility up. You know, I'd love to see a race there in the spring, but it's just not feasible with the timing of their spring Cup race.
You know, these facilities, it's just not... It's just a different set of circumstances than, say, an arena, which can fill its dates after in between the basketball games. It can fill its dates with a circus or, you know, a holiday show on ice or what have you. I mean, this is a kind of a different thing to come bring in another form of motorsports with somewhat the similar ticket buyer in mind to turn around a facility that quickly or to turn around the efforts to sell tickets that quickly.
I don't think I mentioned this on the air. I know I mentioned it to you, but I saw this maybe a month or two ago. Race car engineer on Twitter from a motorsports conference with a suggestion that was made, and I forget who made the suggestion. It was a Formula One engineer type whose name we would recognize. I didn't write it down. I forgot who it was. But it was a well-known name that even those of us in the IndyCar world, I think, would recognize that name. And his idea was drivers should be able to talk to each other during the race, and that should be broadcast. And I thought, there's something going there. That's interesting. If, you know, everybody wants drama, and I think you'd need to limit it to cautions and things like that, but if you could let the drivers, one, talk about strategy, two, yell at someone else, I think you're opening up some things that might get television a little bit interesting.
Yeah, I like that. And I hadn't thought about, because when you brought it up, I started thinking about, well, I don't need the 15th place guy screaming into the microphone just to kind of unnerve somebody up, you know, that he's irritated with. But I think
yeah.
under caution.
Even under caution, that'd be, you know, the leader and the guy in 15th decides. But they're generally going to have decorum because you're going to...
You're representing your brand.
Well, and you're going to treat people the way you want to be treated. So if you do that, then somebody may come back and do that to you the next time around when it's going well for you in a race.
Well, I think under caution, you know, then that is the time absolutely you can do it. I hadn't thought about that stipulation. If you did it during the race,
That's a safety issue.
Yeah, I think there are a variety of things I don't like about it. But during the caution, I think that ought to be open up. Now, that's not to say that everything that you hear gets played, because you know from your experience, you hear all kinds of things that never make the broadcast. But for you to have the ability to put it on the broadcast, I like that.
I think I mentioned that to Terry Lingder, our producer.
What did he say?
I think he had some interest. I don't want to speak for him. You know, and it's just a casual conversation, so I won't speak for him up to whether...
Oh, sure, it's a radio show.
Whether it's feasible or not, because, you know, anytime you come up with ideas, sometimes you sit down and, oh, well, yeah, that's a good idea, but this is why.
Absolutely.
It doesn't
people
work.
A
lot of it would come through. It's got to, you know, go to the sanctioning body. It's got to be approved. And
I like it.
Yeah.
I didn't write it down the last time.
Take that up to the top.
I know people at the top.
Yeah, Jay, Mark, here's what we got going for you. Okay, I still had Twitter questions. I got sidetracked. I will do that, and we'll talk about what we know, car count for the Indianapolis 500 next. Trackside 107.5, 1070 The Fan.
I'm Tony Kanaan, and this is Trackside with Kurt Covin and Kevin Lee on 1070 The Fan.
At Kevin Lee 23, at Kirk Cabin on Twitter. Moose Parrish at HSTA Moose. Quick comment on the Phoenix test. Watch both Dixon and Ray Hall helmet cams. Not only a huge difference in sound, but I love the fact that we could hear the gear changes and the engine revving on the number 9 makes a much better viewing experience to me. Again, Justin Shield looks great. Justin Shield and...
Yeah, I don't...
I don't know that that's what it's going to be called, or it's not going to be called that, but I understand what he's talking about, the hope that something like that might have helped. I don't know if it would have, but it would help in some circumstances, so that's the idea behind it.
Yeah.
If it helps in any circumstance and it doesn't have any negative behind it, we've had some people asking about what's it going to do with a tire. You know, that's part of the testing that still has to come. And then keep in mind there, in some circumstances, you know, a tire going quick enough is just bad news no matter what.
Yeah.
There are some things that are just bad news, and there's nothing that we can think of that is going to make motorsports completely safe. You're just trying to make it safer. And
that's a fair point.
People have been doing over the years. It's much safer than it was, we think, 10 years ago, and then from 20 and so on and so forth. So that's the idea behind that path. Snarky Moose says, how closely does IndyCar watch ratings for other motorsports? And is anyone in Indy concerned about the 22% drop for Daytona? I was a little bit surprised about the ratings. It was a 5.1. Actually, I think the final overnight or fast national was a 5.3, which was down significantly from last year. Keep in mind, this is an Olympic year, so that's a little more challenging that there's Olympics going on throughout the day on NBCSN and on NBC. It was down 10% from 2014, from the last time there was a Winter Olympics.
So the first part of the question, or at least my direct answer, is of course we pay attention to really ratings everywhere. I mean, this is not a, you know, what we've seen from television change in viewership in terms of people's habits. It doesn't matter whether they're watching the Olympics or watching basketball or watching motorsports. I mean, it's the viewing habits are changing across America. Having said that, you know, we think we have a different product. IndyCar ratings over the last 4 years are up 38%. Now, they were down last year a smidge from where they had been the year before, but the year before had been a big jump. Mm-hmm. So if you were looking at your ratings from 2 years prior, they were up. So IndyCar is one of the few forms of sports, and I have documentation that shows this, that where ratings are actually going up. Now, is the base as strong as NASCAR's? No, of course not. I mean, IndyCar would take, even for the Indy 500, would take a 5.1 or a 5.3, whichever number you want to settle at. That'd be a good number for the Indy 500. It hasn't been that high for a while. But you know, the decline in television viewership, especially live television viewership, is down. And it's something everybody's at least paying attention to.
The NBA is going up. They're having, and they've got great storylines right now. They had a great offseason with storylines and drama. The All-Star Game numbers were up a little bit, I think, yesterday.
Well, you know, we talk about,
but that's one of the few. You know, the NFL is down 3-7%. And a year ago, we would have said, well, everything's going down except the NFL. It's Teflon. There's nothing. And I think the NBA is in a unique circumstance right now because they have so many interesting storylines that their ebb and flow is trending upwards for the moment.
And their ebb and flow, and I wouldn't have predicted this, I would have expected that as athletes change teams and markets, that that would be a negative.
Yeah.
It certainly has been a lot of sports. Doesn't seem to have impacted the NBA because they're all still really connected, you know.
And I think it's more of an individual sport. Football is about the team.
It's also
baseball is about the team. The NBA is a superstar-driven league. We can see the faces.
Well, that's just it. You don't have helmets, so that's a big advantage over football and motorsports and even hockey for that matter. You can really see the people and their faces. The other thing is, and this is a problem baseball struggles with, you're a baseball guy historically, in basketball, the stars have the ball in their hands at virtually the whole game.
Yeah.
You know, you may have a great left fielder. You don't see the left fielder except for four times a game or if he catches a fly ball at the warning track.
I love to watch Ichiro play. Well, he may only get the ball hit to him twice. He might not get the ball hit to him at all, and he bats four times. You're right.
So, you know, LeBron has the ball every possession, and if he doesn't, the guy's gone the next week because he needs to be passing to LeBron.
And that happened last week.
And Steph Curry and, you know, all through the league, Kevin Durant, Westbrook, Paul George, Victor Oladipo, they all have the ball in their hands. So, you know, that's a tremendous benefit for that sport. But having said that, that's the way that sport has been played, and they haven't always had peaks like this. You know, they're going through a unique period where they have a polarizing star and several stars around him in different markets, which creates a nice ebb and flow.
Sandberg Moose 23 asks if there's any news on the 2019 TV contract. And Joe also asked, have we reached the point where we won't hear of IndyCar's 2019 and beyond TV deal because there would be a desire not to have ABC promote the Indy 500 as a lame duck property?
I don't think that's first question. No, I don't have anything new to update.
I don't either, and that's the honest truth. I don't know anything.
I don't remember where Mark Miles said this, but he said he expected a decision in the first part of the second quarter. So that would be April. Now, maybe that's May, and maybe it ties to the question that was just posed, that you wouldn't want to impact the Indy 500. But I'll say this, from everything I gather, ABC's still in the picture and still very competitive with their discussions. So,
well, if it is ABC, then it will be announced immediately. There would be no reason to hold that news.
That's right.
And that would be something for them to celebrate throughout the month of May. I wonder if it would be held if it's not because of the lame duck. But I also remember when NASCAR did this latest TV deal with NBC getting back on board and ESPN ABC out. When was that announced? It was announced the day of the first race of the ESPN and ABC portion of the schedule, their biggest race, the Brickyard 400. If you remember that 4 or 5 years ago, that was announced like the Thursday, and the broadcasters, The people working on that broadcast showed up to Indianapolis, and they were greeted with, by the way, you all are likely out of a job either at the end of this year or at the end of next year. So when a deal is done, usually they're going to go ahead and announce it. And I think one reason they're going to want to get it out sooner rather than later is I suspect that that is information that is going to be needed to be known for potential title sponsors.
In fact, that's what Mark Miles has said.
Okay.
One of the, and I don't want to say issues, but one of the hinge points in the discussion, well, it's just fair for any title sponsor would want to know, is what's your TV package? Any supporter, and I guess it wouldn't even matter about title or otherwise, anybody investing in your product would want to know, what's your TV package? So the minute they have it done, I don't know if it's the next day, but it's certainly soon after. And the other thing is, the information won't keep quiet that long.
Yeah, you'd like to announce it on your terms. It's going to get out, especially from the people impacted. And then here's another side from the ABC side. As I said, if it's ABC and ESPN, go ahead and announce it and celebrate that throughout the month of May. If it's not, I also think the people involved are going to want to make that public. I know this. There was a lot of angst last year from the people who love the Indianapolis 500, love being a part of that broadcast, going into that, not knowing if it's the last Indianapolis 500 that we do. And they finished it not knowing whether they were going to come back, because there were a lot of rumors last year about the TV deal getting done, and then whoever is not a part of it, because Mark Miles has said, I'd like to have one partner, whoever's not a part of it, then being bought out of the final year, this 2018 year, of the contract. So I think if ABC is not going to be a partner moving forward, I think they'd want to know, and I also think they'd want to do something within that broadcast. ABC has been a huge part of the Indianapolis 500, the television partner since 1965, I think.
I believe so.
It might be the longest running partnership in sports, which is why it's, you know, a lot of people think it's going to be NBC and it should be NBC, but that's why it's not a slam dunk decision, and all things have to be considered. And there's so many new factors with the digital and ESPN Plus getting up and going, and everybody wants to maintain the digital rights, and that's a really big sticking point in any media rights deal for any sport going right now.
It's a point of real pride for ABC. That's what you were getting at, is for the amount of historical significance they would want to celebrate their time with the Indy 500, especially if they knew at the start of the month, for example, that this was going to be their last. And I have no reason to believe that it will be their last. At this point, all I know is what I've read from Mark, and that is a decision probably is about a month away.
Jim and Fisher says, lots of hype surrounding the new car through all the testing. Has there been any opinions regarding how the racing will be at the Speedway? The 500 has been so competitive and entertaining the last few years. If the new car doesn't maintain that, is a failure, in my opinion.
Well, I hope that's not the standard, because it's been so unbelievable that that would be unfair. Having said that, anybody that, you know, guesses right now at what Indy is going to be like is largely guessing, although you can simulate a lot of things, you know, with the simulations. But I don't think I don't sense any reason that it should be dramatically different. It may be a little different, but that doesn't mean it's going to suffer in terms of excitement.
That's the opinion I've gotten from people talking on and off the record. I'm talking drivers, engineers, is that they think the racing at Indianapolis is going to be very similar.
Yeah.
Maybe not exactly the same. Might not be quite so easy to pass. You may not see 67 or 69 lead changes.
And by the way, that was a few years ago that we had 68.
Yeah. Might be a little bit more difficult, but still can get done.
And oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think it can actually phase back just a little bit, and the passes become more meaningful in that you lead for a while and decide, I want to save fuel and drop back. I thought they were more meaningful passes last year. I thought that there was a point where 2 years ago, I really thought it was just your turn, my turn, that kind of thing. Or maybe I'm thinking of 3 years ago. I thought it's been a little bit more difficult, and it was a pretty good mix. But the general feeling is they think the 500 is still going to be wild, that the aero kits are much different, and the big changes are on road and street courses and somewhat on short ovals, not that much different as far as the super speedway.
Yeah, that's what I think as well.
Joseph Hall, J. Hall 1455, March 27th is a test day at IMS. Suggest plans on opening up stand outside turn two for fans. That's not your area, but would that be considered? That's a lot of going on to open up, because you can still fit quite a few people in the museum stands that are there and on the grassy hills that are inside turn two.
Yeah, it does take...
How do you judge if there's enough interest to open up a grandstand?
Well, I can tell you this. We're going to live stream it. So
okay,
that will change some people's perspectives. I know you like sitting out there and, you know...
Great thing is you can do both now.
Yep, you can do both.
The internet's pretty good, and there's not going to be 350,000 people there. So your streaming capabilities on your phone should work pretty well if you want to do both.
Bring your iPad. Can certainly get there that way. So, you know, I think you'll see a lot of people bring, you know, set that laptop up on their on their car or on the seat in front of them and do both.
I think that adds, in my mind, that would add to the chances of me coming out and sitting there, especially if I'm a hardcore fan and I'm just there by myself or with my son or one other friend. I want to know what's going on. I want to know why hasn't a car gone by me in the last 10 minutes, and I want the talking head to explain or to entertain me with an interview on Pit Lane. Well, this is actually what we're working on right now.
Well, that's good, because there's a decent chance you'll be that talking head. You could talk to yourself.
Is there going to be someone else I can talk to?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I want someone that has access. Or put me on a wireless mic and I wander around. I want to be able to talk. I want to hear from the people involved. I want to hear from drivers that are there watching.
That's what we did in Phoenix.
Exactly. And that's what we did for the Alonso test. It's been
fantastic.
It
may not be Alonso test from the standpoint that we had a full studio.
We may not have 400 or 500 wins in the booth with us, like we had with three with JR.
How many did you bring?
And one with Mario. I helped Zero. For the four. There was four. I'm trying to think who else. We may have even had more. We had a lot of guests that day.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good show.
There's a decent chance you'll be invited back.
The thing is, though, as I've said, I think this is going to be a fascinating day because it's a new package and because it's going to be more than one car and because there's only 4 days of practice before qualifying for the biggest race in the world. And what if it rains 1 or 2 days? People are going to get after it that day.
Yeah,
They're going to want to get a lot done that day.
I always expect that when cars are running, cars have the chance to test. They will get after it if they've got all the abilities to do so.
All right. We will do it next. It's like a tease.
It's been a long tease. You're a big tease.
Or I just lose focus and lose track. But as we always say, I was worried. Do we have enough for the show? We've got plenty, and we will get into what I wanted to get into very early. It's just... where are the possibilities? You saw Robin Miller's story last week of 33. We've been talking about this since December, that we saw a way to get to 35 or 36 cars pretty easily. We'll explain how that can happen next on Trackside.
I'm Ryan Hunter-Reay, and this is Trackside with Kurt Cavan and Kevin Lee on 1070 The Fan.
All right, as we said, we're inside 100 days for the 102nd Indianapolis 500. And in recent years, the question this time of year is, how are you getting to 33 cars? And that's not going to be difficult this year. So we've done a little math, written some things down. Here's how we see things stacking up. We both have the same sheet in front of us. So, Kurt, let's just kind of run down the basics really quick with teams and numbers of those that we know that have been confirmed.
Well, first of all, I think you need to start from the premise that there is a fixed number of engines to be supplied by Honda and Chevy. What that number exactly is internal. I mean, they've keep that number pretty close to the vest.
And some of that is also not just based on how many engines can we produce, but they have to staff them. They have to,
sure, yes.
They have to have a team of people that is assigned to each car and each engine.
So, for example, Honda's number is either 18 or 19 would be a maximum. So you can't give me a bunch of ideas and say they're going to get to 23. They're not going to do that. They're going to do 18 more than likely. They might do a 19th. Chevy will be at a lower number partly because of the contracts they have with full-time teams. So they have a lower number, but not significantly. But when you're looking at the Honda side, I can look at this list and come up with 16 for sure. So I think there will be 18 Hondas, maybe 19, but 16 are where we're at the moment.
That we know of. Now. Uh-huh.
And six of those are with Andretti, with Hunter Ray, Marco, Zach Veach, the rookie, Alexander Rossi, Carlos Munoz, and Stefan Wilson. So there's six at Andretti Autosport. There are at least three at the moment from Dale Coyne Racing, and I'm being a little generous there. We've not seen a confirmation from Pippa Mann, although I think everything points to that happening. The three at Dale Coyne Racing, Sebastian Bourdais, Pietro Fittipaldi, told us that he was going to do the Indy 500, and then Pippa Mann. Ganassi Racing, we only have two down for them at the moment.
And by the way, I think we've seen on the record, I've read it, that Mike Hull, someone of decision, either Mike Hull or Chip Ganassi, has said on the record, two is our number, which surprised us a little bit. We thought that would always come up, but I've seen that on the record, that they are staying at two. Unless something extraordinary happens,
well,
I think there was always the little caveat there.
I'm going to stick them with two for the purpose of this conversation. Scott Dixon and Ed Jones are their two regulars. Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports at this point, and I'm going to give them two. I think there will be three, and I'll make put the little asterisk here. They have a relationship with Michael Shank Racing to run Jack Harvey as well. So that's officially, I suppose, three from that camp. But Michael Shank, I consider a separate entity. The two Schmidt cars, full-timers, James Hinchcliffe and Robert Wickens, the rookie, in this series. And then finally, among the 16 confirmed, you have two from Rahal Letterman-Lanigan Racing. That's Graham Rahal and Takuma Sato, the reigning Indy 500 champion. There is a couple ways that you could get Honda to 18 and maybe even 19. You have another car, a fourth car at Dale Coyne Racing. There could be a third or slash fourth, depending on how you're naming it, from Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports. And there could be a third car from Rahal Letterman-Lanigan Racing, which I believe to be the most likely of these three. So if all three of those came to be, that would put you at 19. Probably 18 is the number, so if you were, say, two of these three would come through, I think that's a more realistic number. We probably should move quickly to the Chevys.
Yep.
I have 13 that I show have been announced. Again, I'm saying that Danica Patrick has been announced since Ed Carpenter just talked about it here on the show. You can go back and listen to the podcast. Be available here in a little bit. Three from Ed Carpenter Racing. That's Spencer Pigot, Ed Carpenter, and Danica Patrick. AJ Foyt Racing has two at Tony Kanaan and Matthias Liest, the rookie. Team Penske has confirmed four of them. Elio Castroneves, Joseph Newgarden, Simon Pagenaud, and Will Power. Juncos Racing has confirmed one, and that's Kyle Kaiser. Harding Racing has confirmed one, that's Gabby Chavez. And Carlin Racing has confirmed two, Charlie Kimball and Max Chilton. So there's 13 what I consider to be confirmed. You have Dennis Reinbolt saying he will have two cars at the 500. And
we don't have driver names, but it sounds like it's going to be J.R. Hildebrand and Sage Karam, but I cannot say that with certainty on either fronts, but that's the prevailing opinion right now. But the important part is, we look at numbers, is that Dennis has confirmed he will have two entries in the 500.
So that would give Chevrolet 15 and Honda either 18 or 19, which gets you to the 33 count without anything else happening. I suppose it's possible that we could see an extra car from Harding Racing.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Barnhart has said that if the right opportunity were available, that could happen. and the Lazier family racing entry. They've come under a couple of different names, but Bob Lazier's fielded Buddy Lazier. I think that's, you know, the least likely of all of them to come to be. They've certainly got a desire to be at Indianapolis again this year, but they've got to get the car in a physical state to participate, which at this point is currently not.
So that's how we get to 33. If we count three coin cars, if we count Pippa Man in as confirmed, even though it's not been announced at this point, that has 16 Hondas, and then the 13 Chevys that we already have officially confirmed, plus you add up the two, so that's 29. Add up the two from Dry and Reinbold is 31, and then at least two of the three extra Hondas, because we believe Honda will do 18. So whether it's a fourth of Dale Coyne Racing, Connor Daly has been mentioned there as a possibility with some partnership. Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports has been mentioned. Rahar Letterman-Lanigan Racing. Oriel Servi has been linked to that one. So two of those three, that's how you get to 33. How you get extra is if Honda goes to 19 and all three of those extra Hondas come together. And if Harding enters a second car, I've heard differing reports. I heard a name attached to one a while back. I won't say it. But I also have heard that, you know, nothing's done until it's done. But that would be a 35th. And then if Buddy Lazier comes in, that's a 36th. Anything beyond that, and let's leave out Buddy. In all honesty, if there are 33 or 34 cars, my advice to Buddy Lazier would be to save your money. I mean, that's just the brutal truth of it. When I read that they've still got parts that they have to buy and things to acclimate last year's aero kit to this year's, it's just going to be very, very tough sledding and unlikely for him to be fast enough to bump someone out of the race. Save the money until you can do it right, or save it for your son would be my cold hard truth in that. So that leaves you back to, I think, a realistic possibility of 34 that could make the race. Where could a 35th come from? I saw a quote from Ricardo Junco saying, we're not planning on a second this year. We need to concentrate on what we're doing. He said, unless, you know, something magical comes together financially for us, expect them to be one. I think Larry Foyt and AJ Foyt have both said, probably not going to do a second one, a third one. We really want to concentrate on what we have here with Tony, and understandably, Tony Kanaan, if all is right, should have a chance to be competitive in the 500.
Sure.
And they need to look after a rookie who is very fast, very talented, but is going to need to be attended to for the first time at Indianapolis. So I wouldn't think that that's likely unless something falls in their lap. I think if Kyle Larson was going to do the 500, I think that would have already been in the plans, and I don't think that they would be so adamant. Maybe it is being thought of, and if he's won a race, to get himself in the chase. But I still think, or in the playoffs, I still think that if and when Kyle Larson does it, it needs to be buttoned up over the offseason, and he needs to do a test at some point before his NASCAR season starts. I would get that done in December at Fontana and get him a taste of an IndyCar so he's started that process so he doesn't have to mess with that in the middle of a legitimate championship season. And now it's not like if you make the playoffs, you're set, it starts all over. You can increase, like Martin Truex Jr. did, your chances of winning the championship by doing well all the way through August. So I think it's still probably in his best interest. And he just sounded like he was hedging a little bit last year.
He sure did.
Yeah, so I don't think that's going to happen this time around. So that's where things stand. You know, Robin listed some names last week as well, names we've mentioned before, like James Davison. He said that Jay Howard is still working on something. We may see him back, and I think Jay seems fairly confident that's going to happen. Mikhail Aloshin, Catherine Legg are trying to find something as well. R.C. Enerson is still working on things. He mentioned Juan Piedrahita. I've talked to Juan, who's done well in Indy Lights at Indianapolis before. He's someone that's trying to put something together. Sebastian Saavedra is running sports cars full-time and still has Gary Peterson of AFS Racing as his partner. So those are some of the names, and there are, I'm sure, some others that I didn't mention, but it's the cars that stand out. So it looks like we are looking pretty likely at 34, 35 if if all comes together. So we shall see. All right, we're done. Tuesday night, 7 o'clock.
I'll be here.
Okay. Tony, thank you much. Tony Donahue produced the program tonight. He'll put the podcast up in a few minutes via 1070thefan.com. For Kurt Cavan, I'm Kevin Lee. Thanks for joining us on FM 107.5, 1070 The Fan.